This is Lorraine bringing it to you, reading Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear by Elizabeth Gilbert, Part 5, Trust, Part 2. The Teaching of Pain. Sadly, Katie's story is no anomaly. Far too many creative people have been taught to distrust pleasure and to put their faith in struggle alone. Too many artists still believe that anguish is the only truly authentic emotional experience. They could have picked up this dark idea anywhere. It's a commonly held belief here in the Western world. What with our weighty emotional heritage of Christian sacrifice and German Romanticism, both of which give excessive credence to the merits of agony. Trusting in nothing but suffering is a dangerous path. Suffering has a reputation for killing off artists, for one thing. But even when it doesn't kill them, an addiction to pain does sometimes throw artists into such severe mental disorder that they stop working at all. My favorite refrigerator magnet. I've suffered enough. When does my artwork improve? Perhaps you, too, were taught to trust in darkness. Maybe you are even taught darkness by creative people whom you love and admire. I certainly was. When I was in high school, a beloved English teacher once told me, "You're a talented writer, Liz, but unfortunately, you'll never make it because you haven't suffered enough in your life." What a twisted thing to say. First of all, what does a middle-aged man know about a teenage girl's suffering? I had probably suffered more that day at lunch than he'd ever suffered in his entire lifetime. But beyond that, since when did creativity become a suffering contest? I had admired that teacher. Imagine if I had taken his words to heart and had dutifully set out on some shadowy, Byronic quest for authenticating tribulation. Mercifully, I didn't. My instincts drove me in the opposite direction, toward light, toward play, toward a more trusting engagement with creativity. But I'm a lucky one. Others do go on that dark crusade, and sometimes they go there on purpose. All my musical heroes were junkies, and I just wanted to be one too, says my dear friend, Rhea Elias, a gifted songwriter who battled heroin addiction for over a decade, during which time she lived in prison, on the streets, and in mental hospitals, and completely stopped making music. Rhea isn't the only artist whoever mistook self-destruction for a serious-minded commitment to creativity. The jazz saxophonist Jackie McLean said that back in Greenwich Village in the 1950s, he watched dozens of aspiring young musicians take up heroin in order to imitate their hero, Charlie Parker. More tellingly still, McLean says he witnessed many young jazz aspirants pretending to be heroin addicts, eyes half closed, striking that slouch pose. Even as Parker himself begged people not to emulate this most tragic aspect of himself. But maybe it's easier to do heroin, or even to romantically pretend to do heroin, than it is to commit yourself wholeheartedly to your craft. Addiction does not make the artist. Raymond Carver, for one, intimately knew this to be true. He himself was an alcoholic, and he was never able to become the writer he needed to be, not even on the subject of alcoholism itself, until he gave up the booze. As he said, any artist who is an alcoholic is an artist despite their alcoholism, not because of it. I agree. I believe that our creativity grows like sidewalk weeds out of the cracks between our pathologies not from the pathologies themselves. But so many people think it's the other way around. For this reason, you will often meet artists who deliberately cling to their suffering, their addictions, their fears, their demons. They worry that if they ever let go of all that anguish, their very identities would vanish. Think of Rilke, who famously said, "If my devils are to leave me, I'm afraid my angels will take flight as well." Rilke was a glorious poet, and that line is elegantly rendered, but it's also severely emotionally warm. Unfortunately, I've heard that line quoted countless times by creative people who are offering up an excuse as to why they won't quit drinking, or why they won't go see a therapist, or why they won't consider treatment for their depression or anxiety, or why they won't address their sexual misconduct or their intimacy problems, or why they basically refuse to seek personal healing and growth in any manner whatsoever, because they don't want to lose their suffering, which they have somehow conflated and confused with their creativity. People have a strange trust in their devils indeed. Our better angels. I want to make something perfectly clear here. I do not deny the reality of suffering, not yours, not mine, not humanity's in general. It is simply that I refuse to fetishize it. I certainly refuse to deliberately seek out suffering in the name of artistic authenticity. As Wendell Berry warned, to attribute to the muse a special fondness for pain is to come too close to desiring and cultivating pain. To be sure, the tormented artist is sometimes an all-trivial person. Without a doubt, there are many creative souls out there who suffer from severe mental illness. Then again, there are also hundreds of thousands of severely mentally ill souls out there who do not happen to possess extraordinary artistic talents. So to automatically conflate madness with genius feels like a logical fallacy to me. But we must be wary of the lure of the tormented artist, because sometimes it's a persona, a role that people grow accustomed to playing. It can be a seductively picturesque role, too, with a certain dark and romantic glamour to it. And it comes with an extremely useful side benefit, namely, built-in permission for terrible behavior. If you are the tormented artist, after all, then you have an excuse for treating your romantic partners badly, for treating yourself badly, for treating your children badly, for treating everyone badly. You're allowed to be demanding, arrogant, rude, cruel, antisocial, grandiose, explosive, moody, manipulative, irresponsible, and or selfish. You can drink all day and fight all night. If you behave this badly as a janitor or a pharmacist, people would rightfully call you out as a jackass. But as a tormented artist, you get a pass because you're special, because you're sensitive and creative, because sometimes you make pretty things. I don't buy it. I believe you can live a creative life and still make an effort to be a basically decent person. I'm with the British psychoanalyst Adam Phillips on this point when he observed, if the art legitimates cruelty, I think the art is not worth having. I've never been attracted to the icon of the tormented artist, not even during adolescence when that figure can seem particularly sexy and alluring to romantic-minded girls like me. It never appealed to me then, though, and it still doesn't appeal to me now. What I have seen already of pain is plenty, thank you, and I do not raise my hand and ask for more of it. I've also been around enough mentally ill people to know better than to sentimentalize madness. What's more, I've passed through enough seasons of depression, anxiety, and shame in my own life to know that such experiences are not particularly generative for me. I have no great love or loyalty for my personal devils because they have never served me well. During my own periods of misery and instability, I've noticed that my creative spirit becomes cramped and suffocated. I've found that it's nearly impossible for me to write when I am unhappy, and it is definitely impossible for me to write fiction when I am unhappy. In other words, I can either live a drama or I can invent a drama, but I do not have the capacity to do both at the same time. Emotional pain makes me the opposite of a deep person. It renders my life narrow and thin and isolated. My suffering takes this whole thrilling and gigantic universe and shrinks it down to the size of my own unhappy head. When my personal devils take over, I can feel my creative angels retreating. They watch my struggle from a safe distance, but they worry. Also, they grow impatient. It's almost as if they're saying, "Lady, please, hold it together. We've got so much more work to do." My desire to work, my desire to engage with my creativity as intimately and as freely as possible, is my strongest personal incentive to fight back against pain by any means necessary and to fashion a life for myself that is as sane and healthy and stable as it can possibly be. But that's only because of what I have chosen to trust, which is quite simply love. Love over suffering, always. Choose what to trust. If you choose to go the other way, though, if you choose to trust suffering over love, be aware that you are building your house upon a battlefield. And when so many people treat their creative process as a war zone, is it any wonder there are such severe casualties, so much despair, so much darkness, and at such a cost? I won't even attempt to list the names of all the writers, poets, artists, dancers, composers, actors, and musicians who have committed suicide in the past century, or who died long before their time from that slowest of suicidal tactics, alcoholism. You want the numbers? The internet will give you the numbers, but believe me, it's a grim reaping. These lost prodigies were unhappy for an infinite variety of reasons, to be sure, so I'm willing to bet that they had all, at least for one flowering moment of their lives, once loved their work. Yet, if you'd asked any of these gifted, troubled souls whether they'd ever believe their work loved them in return, I suspect they would have said no. But why wouldn't it have? This is my question, and I think it's a fair one. Why would your creativity not love you? It came to you, didn't it? It drew itself near. It worked itself into you, asking for your attention and your devotion. It filled you with the desire to make and do interesting things. Creativity wanted a relationship with you. That must be for a reason, right? Do you honestly believe that creativity went through all the trouble of breaking into your consciousness only because it wanted to kill you? That doesn't even make sense. How does creativity possibly benefit from such an arrangement? When Dylan Thomas dies, there are no more Dylan Thomas poems. That channel is silenced forever. Terribly. I cannot imagine a universe in which creativity would possibly desire that outcome. I can only imagine that creativity would much prefer a world in which Dylan Thomas had continued to live and to produce for a long natural life. Dylan Thomas and 1,000 others besides. There's a hole in our world from all the art those people did not make. There is a hole in us from the loss of their work. And I cannot imagine this was ever anyone's divine plan. Because think about it, if the only thing an idea wants is to be made manifest, then why would that idea deliberately harm you when you are the one who might be able to bring it forth? Nature provides the seed, man provides the garden. Each is grateful for the other's help. Is it possible then that creativity is not messing with us at all, but that we have been messing with it? This is Lorraine bringing it to you, reading Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, Part 5, Trust, Part 2. Stay tuned for Part 3.